Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, September 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Cold and flu season is looming. The COVID is still a thing. We've seen West Nile virus cases, other mosquito-borne ailments over the summer. So it seems like a great time to welcome back Dr. Eric Yeager, a virologist and educator at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. You have a question about the common cold, RSV, COVID, etc., give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number, or you can email your question to voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. Eric Yeager and your virus questions coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Eric Yeager today. Eric is Department Chair of Allied Health Sciences at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager has a PhD in biomedical sciences from the University at Albany. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics, and he's here again to take your calls if you have a question. And he's been on these airwaves since really dark times of the COVID pandemic. If you have a question for Dr. Yeager, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number is 800-348-2551. Eric Yeager, how the heck are you? It's been a while.
Doing well, Ray. Great to be here. Thank you for the invitation to come back.
It's really, some of the times you've been here, it was not nice. It was nice that you were here, but it was not a nice time to have you here. This time, we have things going on, West Nile and things like that, but it doesn't seem quite so dire. Let's start with West Nile. Now, that can be very bad, but it doesn't seem to be extremely widespread around here. Tell us what's up with that.
Sure. So you may have heard about West Nile in the news recently, where Dr. Fauci was diagnosed with West Nile virus infection. This is a virus that's carried by mosquitoes. It was first identified in New York State in 1999. I kind of think back to those days. I was a graduate student, and I remember we had to close our windows. The city of Albany was going around from block to block spraying insecticides.
I remember
that. It's kind of a And what the fear there was about the kind of at that point, an unknown virus, well, a virus that was known in other parts of the world, but certainly not in the United States. So a little fear about that virus. But as you mentioned, Ray, by and large, rare cases in terms of severity, very rare cases. Most people are asymptomatic. If you do contract it from mosquito bite, about 8 out of 10 or 80% of people are asymptomatic. About 20% will develop like a febrile illness, so an illness that's muscle aches and pains, slight fever, some headache, kind of like a flu-like illness. But in terms of the rare severe disease you worry about, it's one out of 150 people. So it is a rare disease that can become serious with neurological complications. It can lead to encephalitis, meningitis, and in some cases can be fatal. But by and large, fortunately, the serious severe disease is rare. And the people we most are concerned about are those over the age of 60. That's why, again, with Dr. Fauci, there was a concern because he was in that high age risk group for his age.
Right. Well, I mentioned at the outset of the show, cold and flu season is coming. Is it already here? When does the actual cold and flu season begin?
Typically, we start to see cases of flu, if we want to use that as like a one virus to think about. It starts to creep up about this time, a little bit in October, but the cold and flu season peaks between like December and February.
Okay, so we got a little time.
And the reason for that is, for the most part, we start to spend more time indoors. We're closing windows. The humidity changes, and change in humidity impacts our body in a way that our defenses are a bit weakened. So the mucus that our body produces becomes a little thinner. So for some cases, it's easier for viruses to infect us.
Now, humidity changes.
Yeah.
I've never thought of this. Is it more humid in the winter when we're inside, or less?
It tends to be less.
I mean, that's bad?
It is bad. Yeah, it'll thin the mucus. So, I mean, there's certainly, like when you're indoors, you have different heating systems and different ways to humidify your air. But in general, like with the colder temperatures outside, the humidity is very low. And again, we begin to be indoors, more windows are closed, there's not a lot of air circulating. So just traditionally, even before COVID was a thing, we had to worry about viruses like influenza as well as RSV.
Now, the flu vaccines are being trotted out now. Any ideas, any studies as to how effective they are. It can be something of a crapshoot every year. They go for one they think is going to be it, and have we done it this time?
Data won't really become available until kind of after the season. We do like some Monday morning quarterbacking, if you will. But what the companies and the health organizations across the world do is they do a lot of surveillance to see which flu viruses look to be the most likely to cause infections in humans. And where they look mostly is in the southern hemisphere because their seasons are switched from ours.
Mm-hmm.
So like we look for like cases in Australia, for example, as an indicator or predictor for what viruses to look for. And from that information, the companies that make the vaccines grow those viruses up to make the vaccines. And, they try to match as best they can. In some years, the match continues. It's very good. In other years, again, another strain happens to come up that is, you know, kind of maybe not thought to be the dominant one.
Mm.
Or during the production of the vaccine, sometimes changes can occur in the virus that makes the vaccine slightly less effective. But that said, for individuals, it's not this, I would say it's still worth getting. Even though we don't have that data, it still is a vaccine we know does reduce the risk of severe disease and hospitalization, particularly for those individuals at risk, older adults, those that are immunocompromised, and those that have pre-existing conditions like heart disease, lung disease. There's a lot of data out there to support that getting the vaccine, even if you get flu, the severity is decreased and it wouldn't lead to those more severe outcomes.
So this is what they said about getting the vaccine for COVID as well. If you get it, it should not be as bad.
True. I think with COVID, what's changed a bit there is that the timing of protection isn't quite as long as other vaccines. I think that has been kind of the frustrating part.
So we got
the two things can explain it. I think part of it is the rapid way the virus has mutated. And, you know, we kind of have that crystal ball and go back, like, you know,
yeah.
Think about those shows where you have like the wavy lines and like going back in time to think about what I said back then. Oh, this virus is going to mutate, and scientists thought it wouldn't mutate
as quickly.
And unfortunately, you know, well, the virus proved otherwise.
Yeah.
So keeping up with the strain of virus, you know, means that the vaccine has to be updated. And then just based on how our immune system responds to this virus, the level of protection seems to wane a little faster than our vaccines for reasons that aren't entirely clear, but are being certainly studied.
Eric Yeager's our guest today, Department Chair of Allied Health Sciences at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. When'd you get that new title?
Oh, this was last spring.
Yeah.
So it's been great. I am blessed with a excellent population of faculty, colleagues that work with me in the programs that my department supports in public health and clinical laboratory sciences and cytotechnology. So it's been great. We have a great group of faculty there, great students, great programs. So.
Do you get a throne?
No throne.
No throne? Oh, well, you have to work on that.
No throne.
You need a better agent.
Not that important.
The number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question about viruses and cold and flu season for Dr. Eric Yeager today from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, bird flu. We hear a lot about it. We hear a lot about triple E. Let's briefly discuss that before our break, and then we'll go to the phones.
Sure. We want to tackle first, bird flu or triple E?
Well, the triple E has been in the news a lot. Bird flu, from what I understand, humans can't pass it to each other. But let's cover the basics of both.
Sure. So for Eastern Equine Encephalitis Virus, triple E, much like West Nile, it is a mosquito-borne virus. And much like West Nile, rare in terms of severe cases. I looked at some data this morning. In terms of cases in the U.S., there was an average about 11 cases per year.
Human cases. Okay.
The peak was 38 in 2019. And right now we have, I believe, the current data from the CDC website is 8 cases currently in 5 states. And the majority of those cases are in Massachusetts. It's been in the news quite recently. So again, it is a mosquito-borne virus. People that are over the age of 50. Your listeners might be thinking, I'm getting closer to 50.
Yeah.
Ray, you're getting closer to 50.
I hit 60 in the spring, so
congratulations.
Oh, yeah, I feel great.
So it's not like, you know, it's not one of the advantages of getting older. What it really is that your immune system becomes a little less able to respond as vigorously as it could when you were younger. So that's why typically, and in underlying health conditions, make those older individuals typically at risk for these types of diseases.
You know, we talk a lot when you are on about vaccines. Is there a vaccine for that?
For triple E, not yet. In West Nile, the same. I think there's been work on that. I think it's not for lack of trying with a lot of these viruses. It takes time to develop the right model to study the virus, to understand what is the appropriate target on that virus to make the vaccine against, and then what type of platform, right? We have mRNA vaccines now, protein vaccines, weakened viral vaccines. So all these different platforms are being tested. And I suspect, you know, well, we will have a vaccine against these in the future. It's just taking the research now through that, again, preclinical stages before it goes to human trials.
Viruses, we talked a lot in the old days, three or four years ago, about the coronavirus and sort of how it looks and how it acts and how the vaccine is sort of a key that sort of fits in the slots. Are viruses like Triple E or bird flu radically different in shape and function to the coronavirus?
Yeah, great question. So while there's some structural features of the virus that are shared, they have like a protein coat, and inside that they have their genetic material. I kind of think of my favorite candy as an M&M. Hmm. So you have the chocolate inside, that's genetic material, and it comes in two types, either RNA or DNA. That protein, that candy shell, that protein capsid covers the virus, and some viruses have a lipid droplet that covers them. So there are some structural differences, and that's what scientists have to take into account when they develop these vaccines. And each of these viruses, and I'm glad you remember the lock and key analogy that I used, and each of these viruses has a molecule on its surface, a key that allows it to unlock the door and get inside our cells to start to replicate and make more copies of itself to spread to neighboring viruses and to neighboring people.
Right.
So because of that, unfortunately, there's not like a universal vaccine we can make against all viruses.
And okay, that was my question. Could we brute force it and just slam them all without using a key? I mean, if my door is locked and I can't get in, I'll kick it in.
Right. There are vaccines where what's been done for, you know, like for the example, the MMR vaccine. So there are vaccines where you can combine multiple antigens into a single vaccine, so you're protected against multiple diseases. And there are efforts underway to create like a vaccine that would protect you against both influenza and COVID.
Mm.
But it still has antigens from each or proteins from each virus in that vaccine. So it's not, it's really just combining the two. So like chocolate and peanut butter, again, I'm using candy.
Mm, delicious.
Combining those together to make a single vaccine.
All right, let's take a quick break here. Eric Yeager is our guest today. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you, 800-348-2551. Cold and flus and all kinds of things with our friend Eric Yeager, Department Chair of Allied Health Sciences at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. We'll get to your phones in a moment. Talked about this before. You've been on the show many times, and you know what a repetitious fool I can be. But I'll ask again. We have vaccines for COVID. We have vaccines for flu. No vaccine for the common cold. That's also a virus, right?
Yeah, there's a number of different viruses that can cause the common cold. For example, the adenovirus is one of those. And kind of the same, kind of as I mentioned before the break, it takes the research to determine what is the right target for that vaccine to bind to, and get the immune system to get educated against.
Right.
And then to protect us from that. So I think there's been a lot of work, again, to develop vaccines against the common cold. It's just a somewhat tricky virus. So I think the more information we get, and that's why it's important to have, you know, at the college I'm teaching at, we have a microbiology program, a pharmaceutical sciences program, but many colleges across the country have like these basic science programs. And from that and basic research, we're understanding viruses. So by understanding the basic biology of the virus, that then gives us more information about making vaccines. So from these viruses, it's just, we're still collecting information about them, especially for those viruses that we newly discovered, like Zika virus, for example. Like it's been around for decades, but we hadn't had the ability to study it. So I think with the common cold virus, which certainly we've known has existed for hundreds of years, the more information we get about that virus and the more money we put towards research, that allows us to then hopefully build up better vaccines and antiviral drugs.
You know, you talk often on this program about the immune system educating itself.
Yeah.
Do viruses educate themselves? Is the process of mutation... Obviously, I hope they're not intelligent, but are they saying, okay, we're not getting into our host anymore and we're not successful in getting a foothold, we will educate ourselves?
Yeah, so viruses have been co-evolving with us since we've existed, and with that through you know, happenstance just by how the viruses replicate. They introduce mutations. Think about a copier. You keep making copy after copy after copy, but there's some slight changes in the letters of a paragraph, for example. Well, eventually those changes allow the virus to evade some of our immune defenses. Or some of the more complex viruses that are DNA viruses, they can take genes from us and kind of co-opt those to add to their defenses. So there's, you know, from a virologist perspective, there's a lot of cool things viruses can do. And the drawback to that is that leads to disease and leads them to being, those that are able to cause disease, still a problem that we have to deal with even today.
Are there any positive viruses, things that there do
are.
Good stuff?
Yeah, there are some good viruses. There are viruses called bacteriophages. So these are viruses that infect bacteria and kill them. And these might help us alleviate the problem of antimicrobial resistance.
Oh.
And we have students working at the college to dig up soil in Albany and trying to identify these new bacteriophages that could be used to fight off bacterial diseases.
Interesting. All right, this email from Deb. Eric, where are the media getting the stats from? Please name the epidemiology sources. I have close ties to the local health department, and there are no new alerts about a COVID or pneumonia outbreak or flu outbreak. Does Pfizer have contracts with various health departments? Have also seen their TV ads to keep us healthy at this highly politicized time. Work as a nurse, I just don't see it other than to see vaccines or to sell vaccines. Of course, I fully understand that COVID, like flu, has many hybrids or variants. Please do not take offense. That's from Deb.
Oh, no offense at all, Deb. I think it's a great question. It's we want to know the actual threat, right? You know, we've all been exposed to media stories that kind of ramp up something that's not not WMC.
Well, no, I mean, listen, the entire media everybody in the world got a little bent out of shape in 2020.
Right. So I think having that data is very important. So for many of the viruses like flu and RSV, there are dashboards on the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC website. So they work with both national and state-run health departments to collect data. And what that takes, of course, is hospitals reporting. If they have tests to confirm if the person's infected with flu or RSV, they report that. Did they visit the emergency room? Were they hospitalized? Were they intubated, for example? Did they die from it?
Yeah.
So there is data that's being collected, but it does take effort to survey, to have that surveillance going. I think with COVID, you know, there's during the peak of the pandemic, that data was being collected. We had a dashboard that told us on a daily basis how many test positives, how many infections, how many hospitalizations, et cetera. I think that's been widely replaced a bit by wastewater data. So what some departments of health can do is you can collect the wastewater from a municipal source and look for the presence of virus in that. It doesn't tell you perhaps down to like a street level where the virus came from, but it does give you like an early warning system that maybe the cases might be increasing. So in this case, we might want to warn hospitals that we might expect an increase in cases and we need hospital beds. Other viruses like bird flu, which I'd mentioned before the break, the surveillance isn't there yet. It's kind of self-reported, so we don't have data on that. So it really, the data does exist. There are very good resources like the CDC, and it does vary from one state to the next what they report on their own websites to kind of give us an idea of the threat. Now, it's the good and bad of that, right, is kind of the information is good to help us understand the threat, but if you keep looking at that, it gets a little you don't want to go like too pessimistic.
Okay, so you're going exactly where I wanted to go. Looking back now four years,
yeah.
We all went to that dashboard.
Yeah.
A lot, especially in the newsroom, but everybody did. Is there a case where too much information is available for the general public so they just get completely bent all the time?
Yeah, it's a true balance. Even for me, it's like the data is there for you to access. How many cases? Where do they happen? What was the outcome? Versus understanding what is the true threat. So
yeah.
We talked about West Nile and Triple E. So it is something to be concerned about. But in terms of it being a threat to, you know, when I walk outside the studio when the show's over, like, is that what I have to worry about more so than crossing a busy street?
No.
So it's just trying to conceptualize what is the risk? And then also importantly, too, what can I do to protect myself? So for some cases, we have very good vaccines against these viruses. In some cases, we have antivirals. Or for these mosquito-borne viruses, we know how we can protect ourselves against mosquito bites. So wearing long sleeves, socks, pants, using insect repellents, removing standing water so you don't have like very high mosquito populations locally. So there's things that we know work to help prevent exposure. So again, it's conceptualizing the threat versus having that information available.
Eric Yeager, Department Chair of Allied Health Sciences at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, joins us today. And the number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. 1-800-273-2551. And Gene in Albany, you'll be first. Just hang in there. One more question from me. Very quickly, how does an antiviral actually work?
Sure. So antivirals work against different kind of mechanisms of viruses used to make more of itself. So in kind of very straightforward terms, once the virus gets in, it gets inside the cell, uses that lock and key. It uses its genetic material as a blueprint to make more viruses. And it makes more and more copies of it. Those viruses leave the cell, infect neighboring cells, or they are expelled, like for sneeze droplets, if you're flu, for example, to infect the next person. So having that basic understanding of how the virus replicates, make more copies of itself, scientists have developed drugs targeting each of those pathways in different viruses. Now, I know to your point about, like, can we just have, like, a single vaccine that protects us against all viruses? Unfortunately, the same is true for antivirals. A lot of these work very specifically at that viral proteins and mechanisms. So we can't have, like, a broad spectrum antiviral yet, but they typically target the ability of the virus to get in. They target the ability of the virus to make more copies of itself. And they target the ability of the virus to get out of the cell. And in some cases, we have multiple drugs. Like for HIV, for example, we have a whole range of drugs that can attack different parts of that viral life cycle.
And I assume there are side effects, but we won't talk about any of that now. We'll go to the phones, 800-348-2551. Gene is in Albany. Gene, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about the COVID vaccine. I believe there's one available right now. I've gotten every one, so I've gotten every one. I believe there's one that's available right now, but then I heard there's another one coming out right behind the one that's available now that is going to address the newest strain, because the one that's peaking now is the one that's available, but there's a new strain that's coming behind it, and there will be a new vaccine for that. And I want to know, because I'm traveling in the end of October, when is that other vaccine coming out?
Thank you, Gene, for that question. So the current vaccine that's available now targets what's called the JN1 lineage of viruses. That's based off of Omicron. That became the dominant type of COVID. And to my knowledge, that's the only vaccine currently available to get at a pharmacy right now. Certainly, they are looking at, as the strains vary over time, that they may need to make a new vaccine. I don't know if that'll be in the spring or for next fall, but I can definitively say right now there is a vaccine available. It's against the Omicron variant of virus, the one that's causing the most cases since January of 2024. Hmm. You can get, there's different types of vaccines. There's the mRNA vaccines that people are familiar with now. And there's also a protein-based vaccine. Whichever type of vaccine you get, they're all targeting the same virus. It's a single shot for most of us. So it would be a booster shot for most of us. And in terms of when to get it, I think if you fall within potentially that risk group where you're over the age of 65, you may have some underlying health conditions like chronic lung or heart disease, diabetes. If you're immunocompromised, you know, it may be worth getting that vaccine. Because another question I get often is, well, I got vaccinated and I got COVID, and getting infected by COVID will boost your immune system. It's working against the virus, so it's going to be the same as if it was
COVID, acting
like the vaccine. So it's kind of, if you're concerned of traveling, if you worry about being exposed to the virus and you fall within those high risk groups, if you think you might encounter people that might be in that risk group of people you're visiting, it's worth getting the vaccine now, because again, COVID is not, it's not like flu and RSV where it peaks in winter and comes back down. Like COVID kind of has been with us throughout the year.
Mm.
But I do think that the cases do traditionally peak because we go indoors more, we close the windows, the cases do come up December to February. So I think there is a vaccine available now. I think if you were wanting to get it, I would get it now. I wouldn't wait. I don't think I haven't heard anything about a new vaccine coming out anytime soon. So I think to protect you now with this flu and cold season, with the holiday season, it makes sense to get it now.
All right, Gene, thanks a lot for the call. You know, back in the early days when you were first on this show, early days of the pandemic, there was a lot of talk about, okay, we just got to ride this out and there'll be herd immunity. What happened with that?
We did kind of reach, I think the worry about herd immunity initially was that what herd immunity is, let me take a step back here. So herd immunity is defined, it's an epidemiological term, that when enough people are immune against a virus, that limits the spread of the virus so it can't reach those unvaccinated, non-immune people.
Mm.
So an example would be measles vaccination. So if a high proportion of the population is vaccinated against measles, the virus can't spread. The same is true for polio. That's why there's concern now in some parts of the Middle East where there's conflict, that there's cases of polio coming up, because herd immunity has dropped because, again, people aren't being vaccinated. So you need to have a certain percentage of the population immune for the virus to not spread.
Mm.
The thing that complicates that with COVID is, you know, probably by now, I don't know the number. I'm sure they've tried to model it in terms of what percentage of, like, Albany or New York State or the country has been exposed to COVID. It's probably quite high because it's a very effective virus. But because it mutates enough, you know, having that herd immunity is a little lessened. These other viruses don't mutate as much. So as long as you vaccinate, that virus isn't going to spread. Whereas with COVID, it's yes, the vaccine will prevent spread. But the primary benefit with the vaccine is to reduce the incidence of severe disease, hospitalization, and death that is associated with COVID in certain risk groups.
Has it surprised you how long COVID has persisted and changed and evaded all of our best defenses?
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating that the virus, I would think after some time, like, you know, you exhaust how many times it can mutate to become better, but continually, a very small genome, a very small blueprint to make this virus, it mutates enough to, again, keep us kind of guessing. But same is true with influenza, similarly a small virus, but it changes just enough year after year. We're trying to play catch up. But fortunately, you know, we have preventive measures. We have the vaccines that can reduce. You know, we're nowhere near with COVID where we were back in 2020, 21 with the number of cases per week. You know, COVID is still causing, you know, around 600 deaths per week. So it's not, I don't want to minimize it, but we're certainly not where we were a few years back.
Eric Yeager joins us today. Eric teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Let's go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
This turned into a three-parter.
No, great.
It's been reported that the H5N1 bird flu virus is killing domestic cats. The vaccinia virus and vesicular stomatitis virus are used in combination to fight cancer. And it seems to me that about 50 years ago, there was a Eastern and Western encephalitis vaccine for horses. I was wondering whatever happened to that.
Well, you covered a lot of ground there, Jim. All right, let's go one at a time, yeah. Eric.
Thanks, Jim. I always enjoy your questions. With bird flu, I think, yes, there have been cases where, you know, by its name, bird flu, it was predominantly infecting and killing birds, but it had spread to dairy cattle. It had spread to some domestic pets as well in some in rare cases. I think, you know, I haven't been following its passage in domestic cats and dogs, but I have been kind of tracking it. And, you know, the number of cases is still, fortunately, well, that they've tracked is quite low. There's been 15 cases infected people with the virus. And that one concern is recently there was a case in Missouri. I think it was in the news earlier this week or late last week where it's the first case where the person contracted H5N1 bird flu. And there was no evidence of contact with an animal. So they're uncertain what this means. Does it mean the virus has evolved to go from person to person? We're not quite sure. So I think that's where most of the focus is now. It's not to say that we don't worry about our domestic friends, our cats and dogs getting sick, and there certainly are viruses and bacteria that can infect them. But I think that the transition now has been with bird flu, looking for, is this something that we have to prepare for? And we have vaccines, fortunately, stockpiled and new vaccines being produced against it should this become a threat.
Okay. Jim, thanks a lot. Do you stay up at night just terrified all the time?
No.
No? I mean, there's so many things. Most of us don't even know about some of these things.
Yeah.
You know about a lot of them.
I'm just a terrified New York Giants fan. That's
all. Oh, you're a Giants fan, too? You're the second one this week. And let me tell you, there's a lot of suffering to go around. And I'm with you there,
brother.
That's
what keeps me up.
Let's go to Tommy in Pittsfield. Tommy, you're on.
Hey, I have a question about the Triple E and the West Nile virus. How do you determine if somebody has it or not, or how can somebody find out if they have it? I had my wife at the hospital on Saturday, and they tested her for RSV and COVID, and it came up negative, and they said it was viral, and I'm just like, man, maybe she got one of those.
Oh, boy.
No, thanks for that question, Tommy. When someone's infected with a virus, there's a couple of different tests they can do. We're all familiar with the antigen tests, like with COVID, right?
So
you're looking for, if you have symptoms, the virus is producing its proteins, part of itself, and you can detect that with these rapid tests. There are other tests that are molecular-based and looking for the presence of the viral blueprint in your cells or in your samples. I can't say for certain what tests are available, but typically for a virus, they can do PCR-based tests to look for whether a person's infected. What it really gets down to is what sample to take. Is there enough virus present in the blood or some other specimen? So I apologize for not being familiar with what the exact test is for West Nile and for Tripoli. You certainly wouldn't do it based on symptoms alone, because a lot of these viruses, unfortunately, do have overlapping symptoms like fever, headache, nausea, things like that. But I do, I'd be shocked if there wasn't some kind of like genetic test for the virus.
Tommy, you want to follow up?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Let's take a quick break here. Eric Yeager joins us today. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Quick thank you to everybody who pitched in last night. We had an extended roundtable panel from 7 to 9 in advance of the debate, and we raised a good amount of money for our lockbox. Thank you if you've already thrown in some cashola into that in advance of our October fund drive. You can do it anytime you want. WAMC.org, and there'll be a big link there. You can donate, and there's premiums and stuff. So that's that. Our guest today is Dr. Eric Yeager from Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. 800-348-2551 is our number. And let's see. This is from Valerie, who wrote us at voxpop@wamc.org. Valerie's in Troy. I have heard an official in Massachusetts warning residents to stay in after dark to avoid mosquito bites. I'm in the Capital District, and I've noticed small mosquitoes biting in the daytime. The internet says these are Asian tiger mosquitoes, and they can carry Tripoli. Any thoughts?
I'll say I'm not as familiar with when mosquitoes are out at certain times of day, but they do know which species of mosquitoes, like the Aedes mosquito, for example, is known to carry West Nile and Tripoli. I will mention that the CDC is a great website for this, WHO as well, in terms of which species of mosquito carries it. Mm-hmm. But certainly some of those mosquitoes do, they're more active during like dusk. So they become like better feeders, if you will. So if they carry the virus and they take a blood meal from you, you're getting bit. That's when the virus can be transmitted. So that is one way to avoid a preventive measure, as I mentioned, including wearing long sleeves and using insect repellent, is to limit activity when the mosquitoes might be most active. And this is something that most other parts of the world are dealing with. Like there's a lot of mosquito-borne diseases like dengue, for example. And similar things have to be done. And I think one question might be, well, why are these in the news now? And as Jim mentioned before, Tripoli and it's not something new. It's been around, and there probably is a veterinary vaccine against it, not just for humans yet, really gets the idea of like as the climate becomes warmer. I'm not going to get into that whole political debate about climate change, but certainly we can agree that temperatures were warmer this summer. And when it gets warmer and there might be some increased rain, that increases the population of mosquitoes, that increases their range. So when there's more mosquitoes, there's a chance to, again, pass these viruses on from the animals that exist in nature naturally, some birds, small mammals, sometimes amphibians that might carry some of these viruses. Mosquito bites those, they pick up the virus, and the virus can be transmitted to us. So there's a cycle of viruses in nature that as things get warmer, we get more at risk.
I mean, here's the problem, and this is what kind of scares me a little bit. Mosquitoes are food for many, many things. And if you get rid of them all, that disrupts the food chain. And it's a terrible catch-22.
Oh, definitely. And that's another critically important disease that's spread by mosquitoes is malaria. And it's the same kind of, ethical quandary, if you will, is why don't we just eliminate all mosquitoes? Why do we need them?
Right.
Like, we know they cause disease. They're causing thousands of hospitalizations and deaths. Let's just get rid of mosquitoes. But to your point, Ray, is they're part of this ecosystem.
Yeah.
They're food. Or you cause a crash in a population of some other species.
Right.
And it's difficult to recover from. If you exterminate the population, it's gone.
Eric Yeager has a PhD in biomedical sciences from UAlbany. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics. And let's go back to our phones. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. Carolina's in Fishkill. You're on.
Hi, good afternoon. My primary physician has the flu vaccine available now, but I have been holding off because I had heard that if you got your flu vaccine in like the beginning of October, that you would be more protected throughout the peak months, because it, I think I was told, like, the vaccine really only lasts about 3 to 4 months. Is there any truth to that?
Well, thanks, Carolina, for that question. So there is, the CDC does recommend, and again, I'm glad you're working with your clinician. I should mention that too, as Ray mentioned in the beginning. I'm not a clinician, so a lot of information is based on the viruses. And yeah. I do encourage individuals to always work with their own doctor to make decisions on which vaccines to get and when to get them. In terms of the flu vaccine, you definitely do not want to get it too early. So the point Carolina makes is you don't want to get the vaccine. Probably the recommendations are typically kind of towards the end of September, but definitely by the end of October, you want to get vaccinated, because that's when cases begin to rise and your risk becomes greater. And as Carolina mentioned too, protection kind of is maximal, you know, for the first 3 or 4 months after you get that vaccine. It does take typically about 10 to 14 days for the vaccine to protect you. So you have to keep that in mind too. You're not like immediately protected after getting the shot at the pharmacy or doctor's office. But current CDC recommendations are typically, again, everyone over the age of 6 months should get a flu vaccine. And typically you want to start getting that about this time, maybe next week or late September, definitely before the end of October. There are some populations that may want to get it earlier. So children get 2 doses, so they may want to start that process a bit earlier. So end of August, early September. Or if an individual is pregnant, that can be important, because when the pregnant individual is vaccinated, they can pass the antibodies onto the developing child to protect the child as well.
Okay. Thank you very much, Caroline. Appreciate the call. Tom and Gardner writes, hesitation. That's the subject heading. I had my first booster shot a few years ago. Next day, I lost a good percentage of my hearing. Can you blame me for hesitating to take any vaccine now? And that's from Tom and Gardner.
Yeah. Vaccine hesitancy is a real thing. It's in, and there are instances like with Tom's here where he got a vaccine and then, you know, he experienced something the next day. Was it the vaccine? Was it something else? It's difficult to say. So there are situations like that where people can experience side effects from vaccines. Again, they vary from vaccine to vaccine. And the CDC has been clear on their website for what side effects could happen and the rates of these different side effects. And with every vaccine, it gets to the idea of risk versus benefit. So if the getting the disease is a greater risk to you than getting the vaccine, then it's worth getting the vaccine. In terms of Tommy's case here, causing hearing loss or tinnitus, I'd have to look and see which vaccine, like many of these vaccines as they're tested clinically before they're put out into the public. The companies do list what are the different effects they've noticed and percentages in those 30 participants.
You know, you talk about little kids, 6 months and older, getting vaccines. And you and I have talked about the testing that was done over the past shows that we have done about the testing involved and how fast they rolled out the COVID vaccines. When it comes to flu vaccines, are they all the same? If the virus itself that they're targeting is different, how do we know that these are safe?
So there is a rigorous process, even if a vaccine has been approved. Like, the companies making them undergo this rigorous process to make sure the manufacturing process is still following what they were approved to do, and there's still inspections that are occurring. If there are major changes to the vaccines, again, they have to show that they are safe. So I think with the COVID vaccines, it was a rapid but not rushed process. There were some things that resources able to attract a lot of volunteers for those necessary clinical studies that allowed them to be produced at a faster rate than normal. Also, the modality being mRNA versus a traditional vaccine. So
the mRNA was studied at the base level for years and years prior to that, right?
Exactly, yeah. So I think it is, you know, the new modality does cause some concern. What is this mRNA vaccine? But with all these vaccines, there is a fair amount of work that goes into these studies to show that, again, on a small level first, is it safe to use in individuals? Then the study goes to a next step, a larger group of people, and then a third step for an even larger group of people. And that study continues as the vaccine's been released. So the CDC and other organizations, local and statewide, are monitoring for any kind of ill effects. So if something does happen all of a sudden, a vaccine does cause, for example, there was an increase in cases of myocarditis with the COVID vaccine.
Right.
That was identified because we have these reporting systems to detect that. Because there are in some cases where maybe in those studies, the number of people that got the vaccine was small, so it wasn't detected. And then because we gave it to hundreds of thousands or millions of people, then you start to see these small blips of data. So I think people can take some solace in that. The vaccines, like other pharmaceuticals, there's a rigorous testing process. And then that testing and that surveillance continues after the vaccine has been rolled out.
Well, I mean, you're not a medical doctor, but correct. We know that some viruses, or maybe all of them, will give you, to some extent, a little myocarditis.
True. And that's what, you know, when they, you know, the group that was responsible for looking at, are there any concerns about the vaccine, when they halted the use and did some studies. And as you mentioned, Ray, they looked at the, what is the incidence rate of myocarditis with COVID vaccination versus COVID disease.
Yeah.
And disease was dramatically higher.
Yeah.
So the risk of it, it's, you know, not to minimize the risk that could happen with the vaccine, but it was much, much smaller than if you got the actual virus. So again, with a vaccine, it's always risk versus benefit.
Eric Yeager joins us today from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. And Val writes in, I had a COVID shot a week ago. My understanding is that it is a new, updated one. And then Val found some information online from the CDC that said there was an authorization approval for a Moderna and Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine on August 22nd of this year. So new ones are being rolled out, I guess.
Yeah, that's the one that's currently available. And I think
Novavax has one on the 30th.
Yeah, and thanks, Val, for sharing that. I think the CDC and some other sites as well, your local health department, do a good job of providing information about when was the vaccine approved, who approved it, when is it available.
Yeah.
So I do encourage, you know, listeners, if they have questions about some of that and they want to learn a bit more about the disease or the vaccine, there's some good sources of information. I think, you know, what I would say not to do is, you know, you don't want to use certain aspects of social media that you get this blip of information
yes.
and it's gone. As I do encourage individuals to, you know your source and double check it to make sure, like, what you're seeing, is it actually true? And again, these reputable sources like the World Health Organization and CDC are good ones to go to.
Remember the early days and how much crazy information was out there?
Yeah. All fear-driven. People wanted, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen. We needed to get the information at hand. Once we got it, we understood a bit more about the virus and the threat.
To use fear as clickbait is reprehensible,
agreed.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
John writes in, you're not an epidemiologist, right? But John says, my wife has long COVID. There seems to be very little information about it.
Yeah, to my understanding, there's still, you know, the first trouble, well, so backing up with long COVID. So long COVID is the persistence of symptoms. I believe the cutoff is 4 months past your diagnosis of being COVID positive.
Right.
So if it lasts longer than that, they consider it long COVID. And there's been a lot of studies since the pandemic to understand what can we define as long COVID, which is important because you want your insurance company, you want your physician to understand, okay, do I actually have long COVID? Because there are things that can cause some of those symptoms.
Right.
So there's a lot of work still ongoing to understand, okay, what can we classify as long COVID? And then treatments. And then also, as mentioned, what is the epidemiology? And do people recover? So there's a lot. What we do know is there's a substantial population of people that are still experiencing symptoms after COVID. And there's a lot of work being done to see how we can improve their quality of life. Because there are some sad stories out there where people are completely debilitated. They can't work or go to school after getting the infection. So I think there is data being collected. There's a lot of studies happening now to understand how can we diagnose it. There's some, I think a report came out last year looking at potentially a blood test that might identify those people that are at risk or have developed long COVID. And I think, you know, that's the key, is getting that diagnosis then gives that person some sense of, I don't say closure, but rather than someone saying, well, we don't know what's wrong with you.
Right.
And that's frustrating, right, for any person. So understanding that you've been diagnosed with long COVID and taking it from there, what we can do to alleviate those symptoms.
Let's go back to our phone lines. Eric Yeager joins us today, and we will go to Roger in Granville. Roger, you're on.
Yes. First, my compliments on the excellent presentation you folks are doing.
Well, thanks.
I am a retired large animal veterinarian, and it was mentioned about the vaccines for triple E and Western encephalitis for horses, and the presenter wasn't sure exactly whether it was a vaccine. There is. I just wanted to make it very clear, an awful lot of horses are routinely vaccinated. It's many times can combined with tetanus and other vaccines, and it is available. And it's something for people who own horses. They should be vaccinated for these vaccines. Usually it's a yearly shot. And this does not, while a human cannot yet it directly from a horse, they can get it from a mosquito has bitten the horse.
Okay.
And becomes infected. So just as a matter of clarification and encourage people right now, it works right along with spraying for mosquitoes. If your horse is protected, it's not going to get it, and it can be what's called an inanimate terrier and not get sick, but still contribute into the mosquito population.
Okay. Beautiful. Hey, Roger,
thank you, Roger.
Thanks a lot for that. That was very good indeed. Jill in Waterford. Jill, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, can you be overly vaccinated?
Can you be overly vaccinated?
A friend of mine last night just told me about a friend of hers who says this gal gets like every vaccine known to man, and, you know, RSV, COVID, flu, anything that's available, she gets it.
Mm.
And apparently now she has congestive heart failure, and that's what the doctors have told her. She was overly vaccinated.
Hmm.
Oh, no, thank you for that. And again, sorry to hear about your friend, Jill. The idea of being over-vaccinated was kind of one of those things that sometimes is perpetuated online with kind of the idea of like vaccine disinformation or hesitancy. Now, certainly there, as you mentioned, there can be side effects of the vaccine.
Right.
And you can get, as you mentioned, for the COVID and flu vaccine, you can get those at the same time. The thing to keep in mind with a vaccine versus like your immune response to a virus is with a vaccine, you're typically being exposed to one or a handful of antigens or things expressed by the virus.
Mm-hmm.
If you're infected by the virus itself or multiple viruses, you're being exposed to hundreds, if not thousands, of proteins.
Yeah.
So in terms of like, I guess the idea would be is our immune system has evolved to handle that. We're exposed to multiple insults, viruses, bacteria, fungi, et cetera, each day, and our immune system can handle it. So the idea of being over-vaccinated, you know, for a healthy adult is, I think, it's not entirely, you know, I can't explain her friend's situation per se. I'm not a doctor per se.
Right.
But I think the idea of being over-vaccinated is not true. Like, certainly vaccines are spaced out to kind of enhance the protection. There are some cases where if you vaccinate with multiple vaccines at one time, like there could be some competition with your immune system, what it wants to respond to. But the idea of being over vaccinated.
How she got the vaccines, just that she gets every vaccine when it comes out, she gets it.
Yeah, well, I think it's important.
And
you know,
that's what the doctor told her.
Yeah, I think, you know, with not knowing her health situation, I think there are a number of vaccines that are, you know, really important for individuals to get if they're in these high risk groups with certain health conditions, and always, you know, working with their own clinician to figure out which vaccines they should get and when to get them.
All right, Jill, thanks a lot. Now we only have about 30 seconds. Very quickly, Lauren, you've been waiting a while. You have about 10 seconds. Go.
Okay, what's the name of the phenomenon that was documented and discussed in reputable news sources during the pandemic, where if you get a vaccine, like the flu vaccine, if you get it every year, over time, it's less efficacious as you go on. And so should you wait to get the flu vaccine until you're older?
Okay.
Those are my questions.
Good question.
Thanks, Lauren. So that gets to like an immune concept called original antigenic sin. And the idea was if you're exposed to a certain antigen, the immunological term is original antigenic sin. And the idea is if you're exposed to a similar antigen over and over again, it might kind of... It's like if you were studying for a test and you only read chapter one and your test is on chapters 1 through 10.
Yeah.
You're hyper-focused on chapter one, not on chapters 2 through 10.
Right.
It's experimentally, there's a lot of data to support that. In terms of vaccines, it's still a little murky. There's still a lot of work being done to understand, you know, should we space out certain vaccines?
Right.
And is this a real phenomenon that occurs in people?
Well, you know, it seems like old times. A lot of talk about vaccines and everything else. Eric Yeager, great to have you back, man.
Yeah, great to be back, Ray. I appreciate the opportunity to answer listener questions and to see you.
I asked,
most importantly.
I asked, and ditto. I asked the doc on Monday, who's also a Giants fan, give me an over-under on losses and wins. Give me wins.
I'm hoping for at least 9. It's still an early
9?
Season.
9?
Yeah.
Oh, you're way optimistic. All right, we'll see. Support comes from the Columbia Land Conservancy, bringing people together to conserve, appreciate, and enjoy land for almost 40 years. ColumbiaLand.org. at Historic Albany Foundation, announcing the 2024 Preservation Merit Award, celebrating projects, individuals, and organizations that demonstrate a commitment to preservation on September 25th, historicalbany.org. Thanks again to Dr. Eric Yeager for being here today. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Andrea Leon screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's the Science Forum.